The following program was produced by National Seminars, Incorporated. This cassette program is a condensed version of one of the most popular seminars today, The One-Minute Manager Meets the Monkey. It's a rare opportunity to hear two of the nation's most sought-after business consultants and seminar leaders together in one seminar. On tape one, we'll hear from Bill Unken, author of Managing Management Time, who's been sharing with people his unique way of looking at the art of delegating for over 24 years. He's co-authored the classic Harvard Business Review article, Management Time, Who's Got the Monkey?, which is one of the most requested articles in the history of the journal. On tape two, we'll hear from Dr. Ken Blanchard, an internationally known author, educator, and consultant who has trained many of the world's top managers. His best-selling book, The One-Minute Manager, has sold more than 3 million copies and has been translated into 21 languages. Bill Unken and Ken Blanchard each deliver practical, easy-to-understand management techniques based on the realities of the management world. They attack the toughest problems facing organizations today and offer proven solutions. Now we'll join Bill Unken, who begins by defining the concept of having a monkey on your back.
A monkey is whatever the next move is when dialogue between two parties breaks off. For every monkey, there are always two parties involved, namely, one to work it and one to supervise it. And one of my objects is to help you develop the visual acuity necessary to spot an upward leaping monkey tomorrow while it is still in mid-trajectory. And develop the instant reflex necessary to bat the little sumbitch right back to where he comes from. Because you got to act fast. To tear a monkey that does not belong to you, to tear it off your back, to return it to a subordinate, is as painful as tearing adhesive plaster off a hairy leg. Spare you the agony by batting it back before it lands. And let us say that you are a compulsive monkey picker-upper. And I mentioned that the way you pick them up is in stairwells, hallways, elevator shafts, washrooms, et cetera, anywhere you encounter a subordinate of yours who's perfectly willing to pass a monkey off on you, especially if you have rewarded that person in the past by picking monkeys up from them. If any of you are familiar with B.F. Skinner's behavior modification principle, which reads as follows, any form of behavior that you reward, you will reinforce. Therefore, any time you reward a subordinate for putting a monkey on your back by accepting it, what are you going to do to that individual's likelihood of giving you another one? Anybody? Real quick. They're going to do it more and more, and you're going to be more and more loaded up, and then you're going to be taking work home weekends, and you're going to be spending late evenings working off monkeys that you have picked up from other people, because as Ken Blanchard says, part of the motive of doing that, it's not the only motive, part of it is you fancy yourself to be a rescuer. That type of mentality I have a name for. It is typical of the Northeastern liberal intellectual bleeding heart social theorist who feels that they got to help everybody and his brother. And they sanctify this attitude with a halo on their heads, but what they're doing is ruining their own career and ruining the career of the helpee. All right, let's see now in detail just how that happens. Managers have their pet ways of picking up monkeys. Many of you get from your suppliers the so-called foreman's memory jogger. How many of you are familiar with that? We're not promoting them, but they sell them by, I guess there's not very much manufacturing industry here, or you would know about the foreman's memory jogger. They give it to their best customers to handle their foreman who carry it around in their shirt pockets. That's what is cut to fit the shirt pocket. You ladies, if you ever want to be equal to men in management, have got to arrange to have a shirt pocket, because this goes with being a professional manager, and you're never going to make it unless you can figure out how to have one. These handbags are not going to do the job. And when you walk down the hallway, somebody says, we had a problem. Right away, the compulsive monkey picker-upper picks up a little black book and over here and writes down what the hell the problem is. You're going to solve it for the guy. He says, let me take care of it. I'll get back to you, and so on. But the most commonly used device for picking up monkeys, in my experience, is the back of the envelope. More name monkeys are scribbled on backs of envelopes than anybody has any conception of. And that is why I've often thought of going into business for myself, publishing backs of envelopes in pad form. You can do the half the price for a whole envelope, right? The back is only half, all right. People scribble on backs of envelopes at conferences, in hallways, in meetings, almost anywhere where something comes up and says, oh my God, I think I ought to do that for the poor son of a bitch. And then you go ahead and do it. Scribble them down. Now observe. One trip around the workspace could cause you to pick up, oh, let's say your people are real good to you. You got five people working for you, and each of them only passes one monkey to you in a day. That isn't much. Let me ask you something else. Supposing you're going to be real smart tomorrow, right? You got religion now. And you're just waiting for somebody to pull this off on you. And the individual comes to you and says, boss, we got a problem. So you discuss it. You figure, now, how am I ever going to avoid letting that monkey leap? But now you got it. And then you say to that person, I got to go now. But send me a memorandum on this. Hey, not bad, huh? Who's got the monkey now? Subordinate has, right? You ain't got it. Say, man, this thing of Unkin's really works. Why didn't I think of it before? However, the following morning, what will you pluck from your in-basket? Whose move is it now? Yours. Even if that move is merely tearing it up and throwing it away, you got to do it. If the next move is calling somebody about it, you got to do it. If the next move is to answer it, you got to do it. But the next move is yours. That's why we say a monkey is whatever the next move is when dialogue between two parties breaks off. When your subordinate sends you a memorandum, that is one half of a dialogue, the subordinate's half. Now, we said earlier, by normal business protocol, who has the right to decide when any dialogue breaks off? The boss or the subordinate? Anybody? The boss. So when a subordinate writes you a memorandum and signs it, he has broken off the conversation. He has no right to do that. That is your prerogative. So what do? You got to get that monkey right back to where it come from before you do anything else. How do you do that? Simple. Resume the dialogue. As long as you got the other party talking, it's still up for grabs. Who's got the monkey? Call him on the phone and say, get in here. I want to talk to you about this memorandum you just wrote. And for that, you don't even have to read it. And tell him, sit down. Did you write this? Yeah, boss. Yesterday you told me to send you a memorandum. That's fine. I'm glad I got it. Then you hand it to him and say, read it to me. This is called getting the person involved again. Because unless you do, you'll never be able to get that monkey back to them. So, of course, he surprises. You crazy, boss? Me read this to you? Hell, I'm the one that wrote it. Matter of fact, I could tell you what's in it in one half the time it would take me to read it to you. See, already he's admitting that one half of this is bullshit. Now, there's only one person in the company that knows which half is. Who is it? The person that put it in there. You could read it all afternoon and you would never know which half was bullshit. And you're wasting your time. So he said, I want you to read it. So he starts reading it. And then you interrupt him with Kipling's famous six servants. Who, how, why, what, when, and where. If for nothing else, it's to keep the dialogue going. In the meantime, you're going to learn a lot more about the intent of the memorandum than you could get just by reading the words. Most people who are sophisticated and are products of the schools of hard knocks in management are wise enough never to say in typewritten form of a memorandum what they really mean. This is terribly risky because if you say what you mean, you don't know where that memorandum is going to wind up a month from now. It could wind up in front of somebody's eyes for whom it was never intended. They, not knowing the background, could jump to an erroneous conclusion. And you could be in trouble. has happened to every one of you. So therefore, what do? You never write in a form of memorandum what you mean. You write it in a form that makes sure you will not be misunderstood. And how do you do that? The legal profession has spent 200 years refining the art of writing something that cannot be misunderstood. And the way you do that is to write something that defies all understanding. And if you can't understand it, how in heaven's name can you misunderstand it? And if your subordinates are wise from experience, when they write your memorandum, they're going to leave between the lines what they really mean, right? And what's on paper in a typewriter is going to be safe. That's prudent behavior. Oh, I've gone to courses by readable writing experts who tell managers to write exactly what they mean. The person who's teaching that has never worked in business and written what they mean and survived. Or they wouldn't be teaching this. So here's my second question. There's only one person who knows what's in between the lines. Who is it? The person that wrote it. You can't read in between the lines. There's nothing but blank space in there. Therefore, the rule is never read anything your subordinates write in isolation. It's a waste of time. You have the person there, so you make sure you know what's in between the lines that they were prudent enough not to put there. Then you'll be a lot smarter. Sure, it'll take 10 minutes of your time, but think of the time it's going to save as a result of the misunderstanding that would be created by merely taking a memorandum literally. Now, most of you probably haven't had to learn this, but there are certain kinds that do. For example, like engineers. They always write what they mean. And they're always in trouble for it. They think that the Fifth Amendment right somehow or another applies to engineers. They don't apply to anybody any more than you. I'm not saying that you don't exercise your constitutional right to say what you mean. Of course. But you got to be also willing to pay the price. That goes with a free society also. All right. So anyway, so he's reading to me and say, who, how, why, when. So when we're all through, I say, boy, I'm sure glad. It was 10 minutes well spent, Junior. He's half as old as I am, so I call him Junior. You don't know how old I am. Well, I'll tell you. I'm 72 years old. I should be 73, but I was sick one year. But even... So I said, Junior, thank you very much. I got a lot more out of this now in 10 minutes than I would have gotten reading it all afternoon all by myself. And Junior says, I'm so glad. And he gets up to go. I said, wait a minute. And I grab him by his coattails and sit him down in his chair. Say, we haven't barely started. The next item on our agenda is for you and me to figure out how conceivably the next move on this matter might be yours. And for that, I have all day. Now, he hadn't got all day. That's why he's going to start putting on the pressure to find some damn next move he can make so he can get out of here. That's called negotiating pressure. There's got to be some pressure on the negotiating parties or the negotiation lasts forever. Now, observe, the next move can be a trivial one. Remember, any next move on his part will be infinitely superior than a next move that I would adopt in the same period of time, right? If given a day apiece, he'll do more than I will. Give me forever, and I'll do better than he. That's why we say, any next move made by a subordinate in one day is far superior to an outstanding move made by me, never. We're right back now to the procrastination problem. Because if I don't make the next move, I won't be penalized. My boss didn't know about this conversation. The system doesn't know about it. Only he and I know about it. Therefore, I can procrastinate with impunity. What are the odds that he can procrastinate any next move we decide on? Zero. So here's what we're saying. Why do you pick up these monkeys? You get back to your desk, and if you have gathered up monkeys on backs of envelopes, of course, you pull these scraps of paper out of your pocket, right, 5 or 10, 15 of them, and you lay them on your desk. And when you do, you look in your in-basket, and you notice that while you were absent gathering monkeys, your boss had not been idle. Your boss is pregnant with monkeys. So, in your in-basket, there are a bunch of please handles, or see me's, or the killer of them all. What's this? So here they are. Now, anybody knows that these monkeys you got from your subordinates are the important ones because they come out of your own operation, right? That's what you're paid to do. That's what you go to work to do. The ones you get from your boss are annoying trivialities, are they not? But you also know which you're going to handle first. So the way we express it is this. At anything you fail to do that your boss expects you to do will make you guilty of insubordination. That's why you give it the highest urgency. Anything that you fail to do that your subordinates expect you to do is not called insubordination. It is called procrastination. But you've got to get rid of procrastination in order to get on with your job. So how do you get rid of procrastination? Watch this. Only managers can do this. Managers are only about 15% of the payroll. So 85% of the people in your companies don't have access to what I'm going to show you right now. You are a privileged few. The way you get rid of procrastination is to pick up all loose monkeys, which, if you do nothing about them, will make you guilty of procrastination, and put them on the backs of those who, if they do nothing about them, will make them guilty of insubordination. And that's how you get rid of procrastination, which says that the simplest way to raise the urgency of anything that's on your desk is to drop it down one level. It is automatically now more urgent than it was on your desk. Many of you carry briefcases back and forth between home and office, home and office, home and office. Briefcase, we call them monkey cages, right? That's where you carry them. Some of those things that you take home in the evening, you work off that night. In spite of every odd, you work them off. I ask you to guess, what are those, boss imposed or subordinate imposed, if you work them off that night? Boss imposed, obviously. If you get to any others, they would be system imposed. But you've got some things in your briefcase that you've been toting back and forth day after day after day that has been 6 weeks before you even got to it. Obviously, what kind of stuff is that? That's a self-imposed and it's the most important part of your job. Your company knows it, you know it, but you can procrastinate it with impunity, and that's, of course, why you carry it back and forth. Now, all we got to do is take all of this stuff in your briefcase that is procrastinatable by you and put it where? In the briefcases of your immediate subordinates. If they do nothing about it now, what will we call that? Insubordination. That's why something is going to happen. Not much, maybe, but something. Do you realize that a monkey cannot tell from inside a briefcase whose briefcase it went home in? Now, if it makes no difference to the monkey, why the hell does it make so much difference to you whose briefcase? I make it sound all very simple. But I'll tell you from my experience, some of you younger ones haven't had all this experience, I'll tell you from my experience, it is not as simple as I'm saying. What I hope is I don't commit the crime of making it simplistic. Look how utterly insidious this monkey-picking business is. Do you remember in that little game that we played? You know, I'm walking down the hallway and who was it? I guess it was Will. Said, boss, we got a problem. I can start right there and so on and so forth. Did you notice how he opened the conversation at point B? He says, hi, boss. We've got a problem. By saying we've got a problem, he arranged for the monkey to be already halfway from his back to mine. He started that monkey on his career astride both our backs. One leg on his, one leg on mine. And all the monkey got to do is lift the wrong leg. He disappears, and I got the whole damn thing. That's why you got to be sharp and alert and quick. Now, let's say that this is you. You got four subordinates reporting to you, whom we shall call them. That makes you a tight little team. You are the chief, they're the Indians, and that's a nice little tight little team you got going there. Now, there's only one person among the five of you who's in a position to speak for the entire team and say, we've got a problem. Who is that person? You. Therefore, if this person here says to you, Boss, we've got a problem. He or she is guilty of a presumptive form of address showing poor upbringing and lousy breeding. That person is in no position to speak for the whole team and say we got a problem. Therefore, the only proper form of address on that person's part is what? I've got a problem, and it's your job, Mr. and Miss Boss, to see to it it stays that way. Hi, boss, I got a problem. Oh, I can see some of you got fire in your eyes. You just can't wait until tomorrow morning to tempt one of these people that's been making a patsy out of you for months, if not years, right? And you walk down the hallway, making yourself very obvious to smoke... to smoke that person out. They fall for the bait. And they say to you, good morning, boss, we got a problem. It's going to be Joe this time. Good morning, boss, we got a problem. And I can see what you're going to do. You're going to go overboard, of course. And you always make a fool out of yourself the day after you get religion. But flush with enthusiasm, you're going to say, wait a minute, Joe, just wait a minute. You wouldn't believe what I learned from Unkin yesterday. I learned from him that we have never had a problem. We don't have one now. And if I have anything to do with it, we will never again have a problem. Now, Joe, that does not mean that there is no problem. Of course there is, and you're one of the best problem finders I've got. You're very valuable. However, the first item on our agenda right here in the hallway will be for us to decide who's got this problem, you or me. Now, if it should turn out that you've got this problem, I'll do everything I can to help you with it. If it should turn out that I've got the problem, I'm sure you'll do everything you can to help me with it. But no matter which way it comes out, the next move will be yours in any case. Now, Joe, what's the problem? Now, he wonders why he brought it up. For every monkey, there are two parties involved, namely one to work it and one to supervise it. What this says is, contrary to what you've been taught in supervisory training courses, contrary to what you've read on books on how to supervise, it is not your job to supervise people. Many reasons for this. The principal one is people are cantankerous, they are obstinate, they are stubborn, they got their own ideas, their way is always better than yours. If that were not true, supervisory training courses wouldn't be as popular as they are for the last 50 years. They're popular because nobody knows how to supervise people, they can't do it, so they go back and take another course. Your job is not to supervise people. Your job is to supervise monkeys. Well, then you may ask me, well, then why do I need people? And the answer to that one is, what you need people for is to provide backspace to lay the monkeys on so you can supervise them. You pick up a monkey and put it on your own back, there's no way you can supervise it. You can't see it. You try to reach for it, it'll scramble over to your left shoulder. You try to reach for it here, it'll scramble over to your right. You try to reach down this way, it'll shinny down. You go up that way and it'll shinny up. There's no way you can supervise a monkey that's on your own back. That's why you got people, so you got enough square feet to lay enough monkeys on so you can supervise them, and that is the only way you can go. Once you get that through your thick skull, it'll relieve you of an awful lot, right? You don't have to worry about human psychology anymore, right? Your people are only carriers. But you do need to know a lot about monkey psychology, and that's why I'm spending so much time going over with you the psychology of the monkey, because monkeys have no instinct to move down. Their instinct is only to move up. There are millions of monkeys, millions, that's an exaggeration, probably hundreds if not thousands of monkeys at all levels in your organization. That is, next moves that have to be made by somebody. Monkeys are lighter than air. Left to themselves, they rise. They have no instinct to go down, only an instinct to go up. If somebody doesn't do something to stop the upward flow of monkeys in any corporate organization, where are they all going to end up? Remember, the organization is pyramidal in shape. Where are they all heading for? They're heading for the CEO's office, and if somebody doesn't stop this flow, the CEO is going to be up to his elbows in monkeys. That's what delegation is for, is to slow down the upward movement of these masses of monkeys. So now, a little bit more on monkey psychology. Let's say that I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 people working for me. Say that I'm a regional manager of a marketing division of a nationwide company, and so you know, therefore, what I got to do. Since I'm in the marketing area, I've got customers, et cetera, and this guy here, I might as well tell you what our business is so that you can relate to it. Our company manufactures and sells souvenirs from any part of the world. We export these souvenirs all over the world so that rich Americans who can afford to travel can buy our souvenirs at the Taj Mahal, and they can buy them in Japan or the Kamakura Buddha, and they can come back and adorn their living rooms with them. We also sell these exact same souvenirs to poor people in this country through discount outlets like JCPenney's and others, so that the poor who cannot afford to travel can adorn their living rooms with exactly the same souvenirs that the rich can. This is our patriotic contribution to the egalitarian aims of our society, and our sales slogan is that while all men may not be created equal, we're going to make them equal, and that is our... This is our sales slogan, and it has been really responsible for tripling our sales because we have an idealistic aim in our business besides just making money. Anyway, I'm the regional manager. My headquarters is in Atlanta. My territory is the Gulf States and Georgia. He is my assistant regional manager for traffic and transportation. He's got a string of warehouses, some of them owned, some of them leased. He's got a string of trucks, some of them owned, some of them leased. His job is to make deliveries to our retail outlets in accordance with the promises made to them by our sales force. I ask you, whom does he consider to be the source of almost all of his problems? Salesforce, I was in, he's often told me that he'd be able to manage his job if we just fired the Salesforce. After all, they make promises he can't keep, and that's where all the trouble comes from. He meets me in the hallway and tells me one day that there are 3 truck drivers locked in a phone booth in Mobile, Alabama, hanging on long distance waiting for an answer. Sears Roebuck, to whom the goods were consigned, claimed that they never ordered the merchandise and kicked the trucks off the property. The truck driver want to know what to do now. He's telling me that he needs empty trucks like he can taste them. He don't give a damn about the merchandise. He needs empty trucks. He told me what he tried to do to get rid of the loads. No, the warehouses are all full. Can't find any orders for them. And so what do I say? Look, I've been in this business for 25 years. Who should know more about what to do, him or me? 25 years of experience, I cannot turn the opportunity to let him know what experience does for somebody. So I say, oh yeah, what are the order numbers? You're all this, don't worry about it. I'll work it out. And I picked up another monkey. What I didn't know is I've just committed myself to 2 hours of hassle on the phone with the headquarters to get this straightened out. But I didn't mark 2 hours past it. Oh, handle it. Yeah, an old experience hand like I have, but there's hardly a problem around I can't solve. Anybody got any? The thing you got to do is recognize the monkeys when they come, but they'll come from anybody, regardless of their occupation, regardless of their line of work, and regardless of the level in the company. Well, now, having got all that far, let's see now what happens. Let's say I picked up 15 monkeys. He gives me 3 a day, which isn't very many. So by Friday, I got 15. What am I going to do with them? Well, so, of course, my solution to it is to put in longer hours. And I do. I decide now that I'm going to have to get caught up. So I decide I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to take a Friday afternoon as private quiet time to get caught up. I have a friend of mine who wrote a book on time management who says every manager should have quiet time. You know he's never been a manager, right? Can you imagine being in your quiet time and then your secretary says there's a customer outside wanting to see you? And then you have her tell him, sorry, the boss has no time for customers. This is his quiet time. I mean, how crazy can you be? But intellectuals, of course, don't understand this, so you have to be tolerant of that kind of advice.